This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Korerotia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa. No mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Korerotia. Tune in as our guests Speak Up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Over the last 4 years, there have been commemorations throughout the world to remember the centenaries of various key moments of World War I, particularly major battles. For New Zealand, these major battles include the ill-fated Gallipoli campaign, as well as several battles along the Western Front. 11th of November 2018 marks 100 years since the signing of the armistice that ended World War I. And so, we're currently about to commemorate not the actions and losses of individual battles, but of the entire war. With fighting in Europe, Africa, and the Middle East, involving soldiers from countries across the globe, World War I was a first in terms of its geographical scale, as well as in the industrialized forms of warfare employed, such as machine guns, gas, and tanks. The combination of huge numbers of mobilized soldiers, plus advances in technology, also resulted in another first, the number of dead. Some historians estimate about 40 million casualties, of which perhaps 10 million were military deaths. The sheer vastness of World War I, particularly in terms of the numbers of dead, makes a compelling argument for remembering and commemorating. We must remember in order to pay homage to those who died, as well, crucially, so that we remember and don't repeat history. Yet, how much sway does this argument actually have? Remembering World War I and other conflicts has not prevented humankind from resorting time and again to war. So on today's episode of Speak Up Korerotia, I, your host Sally Carlton, invite three people who have researched the commemoration and teaching of war and peace to reflect on the question, does teaching about war translate into teaching about peace? We will talk firstly with Rowan Light, researcher of Anzac Day, Australia and New Zealand's commemoration of Gallipoli. Secondly, we'll check with Katerina Standish about her work on the acknowledgement of violence in school curricula, before finishing up with Laura Jones, education specialist at Te Papa. Rowan, welcome to the show. It would be fantastic if you could introduce yourself and a little bit about your research, please.
I'm a lecturer at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand history. So I've just finished my PhD in the history of Anzac Day in Australia and New Zealand. And I suppose the PhD sort of came out of a few questions I had when I was studying in Sydney and when I was doing my honours there on a quite different topic. And I was, you know, talking to historians at University of Sydney and friends, and I went along to the Anzac Day service, knowing that this is something we share with Australians. I was struck by many of the differences. And so my research was really asking that question, well, how much is this something that we share? And what are the differences? And I suppose thinking about the 2015 centenary and really asking, well, how did we get to that point? How do we account for such a huge interest and kind of investment in that centenary, which is both sort of financial and emotional and this mixture of personal and all these different energies that have gone into us?
And what were the big differences, according to your research, between Australia and New Zealand's commemoration of Anzac Day?
One of the ways that historians have kind of talked about a difference in sort of tone and texture of our Anzac commemoration between Australia and New Zealand has been, well, on the one hand, okay, we share certain similarities in kind of language and ritual. So we, you know, we talk about the sort of sacrifice and you know, the values of Anzac Day, you know, integrity and sort of service. But whereas in New Zealand, I think we tend to associate those in a broader kind of, well, firstly, I think we think of those in terms of as a relationship between Australia and New Zealand. So something that we share perhaps speaks more to the kind of global context of the First World War. Whereas in Australia, what is quite clear and striking is the way in which Anzac is really a synonym for Australian. So there's a sort of very strong association between a national history and what took place at Gallipoli. And so my research really kind of confirmed that in the sense that we really sort of traced how New Zealand's sort of Anzac commemoration has taken place in a broader ecosystem. And so that was kind of the second part of my research, was really looking at if this is something that we reportedly share, how has the Australian kind of commemoration shaped New Zealand commemoration? What I found was the way in which the Australian sort of state commemoration has exerted quite a profound influence over the way we've come to commemorate Gallipoli, particularly in the last 20 years.
As an Australian living in New Zealand, one thing that I noticed when I've attended Anzac Day ceremonies is it seems to be a lot more religious here.
Yeah, that's quite a common observation. One of the ways that I tend to describe the differences, commemoration is never just one thing. It's never just sort of an official government policy. It's very much a collection of different groups and institutions and people giving input into how we remember a particular historical event. And whereas in Australia, I think there's quite a strong, centralised and quite a strong institutional kind of network through things like the Australian War Memorial. In New Zealand, we've had quite a decentralised, quite a local tradition of Anzac commemoration.
You've mentioned the more centralised approach in Australia versus the more localised approach here. If we can move on to thinking about, I guess, the teaching of Anzac Day and commemoration is, in one respect, a way of teaching. It would be great to think about how you see the teaching of Anzac Day through commemoration changing over time.
You know, we talk about Anzac Day as this thing, but of course it's changed over time and changes over generations. And so I suppose it might be helpful to think about, well, when we see the first kind of formation of Anzac Day and after the first one in 1916, and then sort of developing over the 1920s, this Anzac Day emerged as part of a kind of broader tradition of national kind of history and within a British and imperial worldview, that it would sort of inculcate a sense of what it meant to be British, a British patriot and citizen in the empire in the 1920s and 30s. And so we see very much an emphasis on commemoration as a sort of moral pedagogy.
What might be interesting for us to hear is the differences between commemoration in the past, when it was perhaps more led by the RSLs and the RSAs, veterans themselves, versus how it is now that's more led perhaps by the state or by education.
If we look at, for example, in 1965, we have the 50th anniversary of Gallipoli, and that's sort of the first really big anniversary, and we're always very interested in anniversaries as kind of these interesting kind of milestones. In 1965, we have in many ways a kind of classic snapshot of how Anzac commemoration had developed in those 50 years, and one of which was that the central sort of protagonist of commemoration was the returned servicemen. In 1965, for example, we have a pilgrimage to Gallipoli run by the RSL. In Australia, the Returned Service League, and the RSA, the Returned Service Association, and the New Zealand counterpart, and this is they are the organisers, and there is some sort of government support, so they do ask the government for support, but it's very limited. What is both the Menzies Liberal government in Australia and the Holyoke National government in New Zealand are very reticent about getting involved, because they see the role of the RSL and the RSA as the primary organiser. In fact, one of the interesting concerns of the state at the time is that if they set a precedent for becoming sort of financial supporters of commemoration, that might lead down the track to more commitments. And there's an interesting kind of irony in that, given what we've seen in the last 4 years. But so the sort of in the 50th anniversary, this sort of in 1965, very much the commemoration being about the returned servicemen as an exemplar of kind of the soldier citizen. And so that sort of tradition holds up, particularly in New Zealand, for quite a while. But even in 1990, the 75th anniversary of Gallipoli, again kind of seen as this important moment, again the New Zealand government says, well, the primary organiser here has to be the RSA, so that the RSA produces kind of the first kind of educational kit, wonderfully called the model that moulded the nation. And it was effectively like a video in a sort of education kit for teachers, which was sent to schools and to be used in classroom contexts. And that's the first kind of attempt to go from, okay, well, you know, schools, you know, having students attend Anzac Day, and so a broader sort of community sense of commemoration as teaching, to a shift towards thinking about national history and kind of in terms of military heritage. And that's kind of very much connects with changes in the 1990s, which is when we start to see a big discussion about the role of history in the national curriculum.
So I guess thinking about from the 1990s onwards through till today, and the place that Gallipoli, Anzac Day, World War I hold in New Zealand education, is it a big part, do you think, and is it too big or not big enough?
Well, it's an interesting question because while part of the problem of talking about the teaching of any given subject in New Zealand schools is that we actually don't have great data about that. And the difficulty is, on the one hand, we have quite an open curriculum, which gives teachers and schools and communities a lot of flexibility in what they decide to teach. There's still attempts to kind of survey and really get some good data on what's been taught. I think that in Australia there has been a really interesting debate about this, where there has been, since the 1990s, in particular the early 2000s under the John Howard Liberal government, where there was a strong push to connect Australia's kind of military heritage with national history. That was really led through the Department of Veteran Affairs, and in particular, if we're thinking about, well, commemoration is never one thing in isolation. It's always about a broader sort of ecosystem of commemoration, and within the Department of Veteran Affairs, we have something like the Australian War Memorial is sort of situated as a kind of key cultural institution in Australia. There's been a big debate in Australia about the appropriateness of this, and, you know, why do we have one department? We would expect sort of the RSA to want to promote historical narrative which supports their cause, their community. But the question becomes, well, why do we give preference to one, in this case, to the Department of Veteran Affairs? Why was one department given the resources to kind of push a particular historical narrative? Why not the Department of Immigration or Environment or Aboriginal Affairs? You know, so these were the sort of questions being asked in Australia. The need to be critical about sort of state narratives and very conscious of I suppose, the work of memory and remembrance, which does imply forgetting. So, you know, when we put energy and effort into remembering, it necessarily means we're forgetting other things. And I think an interesting way we can kind of complicate the picture of 1915 in terms of our, I guess, the thinking about the implications of what we decide to remember is very much when we think about the histories of violence and genocide would be the Armenian genocide, which is something which at a public and official level we don't really give enough recognition to, despite the fact that scholars have really established a fair consensus that the landing at Gallipoli was a key kind of trigger for the Armenian genocide, which begins more or less in the same day in April 25. So it does provide one example of the way in which that what we choose to remember and invest in our commemoration can silence and can obscure other histories of violence.
And I think to add to that point, whereas it's in some ways easy to remember Gallipoli from a New Zealand perspective, remembering the Armenian genocide has a whole load of very difficult political relationship issues that come with it.
Yeah, precisely because of our contemporary politics and our relationship with the Republic of Turkey, and who do not recognise the genocide. And precisely, so we see the entanglements and the sort of politics of commemoration, and that they're never neutral, that these sort of narratives that we tell each other on Anzac Day are never neutral.
In Australian and New Zealand national curricula, teaching about World War One and Gallipoli and Anzac Day almost comes with a kind of a moral lesson, which I suppose the commemoration itself does as well. And this idea that you've got to be taught about it in order not to forget about it. Does it work? And are there dangers perhaps inherent in teaching about war?
It's a fraught question. And I suppose stepping back and we look at the history of history teaching and history in Australia and New Zealand, sort of one of the promises of history is that it does provide this kind of moral pedagogy. There was a strong tradition that history was crucial to kind of that moral enterprise of empire and ensuring that Australians, British Australians and British New Zealanders would see themselves connected in that broader project of empire. And we see that certainly in how things like the New Zealand Wars were taught and commemorated from about the 1880s up until the 1930s. A story of Māori and Pākehā coming together from this violent moment in our history, but coming together and forming a sort of a unity, a national unity, and very much became a foundational kind of myth of our race relation, a crucial kind of cultural narrative up until the 1960s and 70s when it started to sort of fall apart and shown to be a bit hollow. And this is, again, a debate in Australia. We've seen a lot in Australia about the promise of history as a kind of as civic education. I suppose my tendency is to see there is certainly that aspect of history, but history in many ways is less about the familiar and more about the unknown, and actually inviting students to consider not simply the narratives of their communities and their families in a way which can be quite empowering, because I think that's what history provides, this way that the past kind of provides those meetings and relationships in the present. But I think one of the promises of history is also precisely in its ability to question orthodoxies and to look at things differently. So rather than simply looking at a set of values which we share, but also giving students the critical tools to be able to question those and think about how they've changed and how they've developed. So for me, something we need to give more airtime to is the history of protest and Anzac Day, and something which we often forget about. In fact, a couple of years ago, if you remember, there was a bit of a moment of public debate when there were some protests and Anzac Day. To me, what was interesting is that we'd actually kind of forgotten that we actually have a really rich tradition of protests on Anzac Day. You know, the debate was, is it appropriate on this sort of sacred occasion?
So just to finish off, a final question for you. What would you like to see happen in terms of teaching about war and teaching about peace in New Zealand, whether that be through commemoration or education?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? We're at the end of the centenary. We'll be talking about how we've commemorated the First World War for many years. I think we'll be looking back and sort of asking, well, did we do it right? Did we get it right? Did we miss a bit of an opportunity? And I do wonder if we have. You just look at the ministry's sort of World War 100 website, and we're coming up to November 11, the armistice. There's not much going on. And I think in many ways, partly that's practical and financial, was that we've exhausted ourselves, I think, at the end of this four-year slog. And we committed a lot in those first 2 years, really about Gallipoli. And we see that in our national museum, Te Papa's, the decision to have one exhibition, extraordinary commitment of resources and space to Gallipoli. And I think the important thing to remind ourselves is that we make war and we teach war their actions. You know, we invest in them. Similar thing is with peace. You know, we make peace, that it doesn't just happen. I think the value of teaching peace is it provides our students with the critical skills to and a vocabulary and a conceptual framework for thinking about how we can actually live in peace and how we can work through differences and the way in which history can provide those examples and meetings and relationships in the past that we can draw on in the present. So all of this is quite interesting when we're thinking, you know, we're sort of coming into more of a debate about how do we commemorate things like the New Zealand Wars, you know, which were an important part of our public commemoration 100 years ago under different circumstances, but how do we grapple and come to terms with this another history of violence in our country, one which is more local than perhaps the foreign fields of World War One, and therefore a little bit more uncomfortable.
You've raised a really excellent point with the difference in how we look at particularly Gallipoli, but World War One more broadly, and the New Zealand Wars, and the vastly different coverage, I suppose, that they get. I think it's a really important point. I'd like to say thank you very much for coming in today, Rowan, and for sharing your vast wealth of knowledge on Anzac Day across the Tasman. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
We're talking now with Dr. Katerina Standish, Deputy Director of the National Centre for Peace and Conflict Studies at the Uni of Otago, and she's also a researcher of peace in international curricula. I thought, Katerina, if you could just introduce yourself and a little bit about the work you do, particularly if you wouldn't mind focusing on the key findings from your work about pedagogy and the teaching of war and peace.
I basically focus my work in peace and conflict studies sort of around three areas. One is looking at elements of peace building in mainstream education, and peace education is a form of peace building. One of my other areas is looking at life-ending acts, and one of my other areas is looking at sort of what's considered meta-violence, or sort of the connections between cultural structure and direct forms of violence in society, sort of those reinforcing aspects of it. So I wouldn't necessarily say I am an expert on New Zealand pedagogy, but I can tell you that I've done an analysis of the curricular statements for both the Te Whariki Early Childhood Education as well as the New Zealand years 1 to 3. And what I've done is I've analyzed those for three different elements. The first one is recognizing violence. The second one is transforming violence, but doing so nonviolently. And the third aspect is looking at what kind of aspects are in place to prevent and or intervene in violence when it's in front of us. So I'd be happy to share my findings with you. And I was just going to preface this by saying that, you know, New Zealand, like most countries in the world, has a mainstream education system, meaning the majority of students gain the same or similar forms of education. There are always special character education or specialty schools, etc., but mainstream education in New Zealand is what I looked at. And I looked at the English language medium because that's the language that I'm most comfortable in. So when I analyzed New Zealand, it was part of a larger program that I was working on called the Peace Education Curricular Analysis Project, and that's an international and comparative piece of research that I'm doing, and it's available online, 100% transparent, if anybody's interested, at pikaproject.org. And the idea is to look at mainstream education for peace education, because peace education is typically considered to be sort of a fringe or fragment form of education, something that's kind of an add-on or a bit sort of sidelined. But I wanted to take a look at what kind of peace education elements were actually already present in mainstream education, because the reality is that in most instances, you actually do find peace education elements in so-called mainstream education, so-called non-peace educations. And so I looked at that. But I will say that I was interested to find that, having done about 10 different countries, New Zealand seemed to have a very sort of interesting divide in terms of what I consider in my research to be element one, which is recognition of violence. And the reason why recognition of violence is important is because you can't transform violence if you don't see it first. So what I was looking for were instances in the curriculum where violence was recognized. And when I analyzed, for instance, the New Zealand 1 to 13 curriculum, and this is the main curriculum statement for most students who attend schooling in this country, I found only one statement that recognized violence, and it's really short, so I could read it out for you. The statement is, "This curriculum is non-sexist, non-racist, and non-discriminatory. It ensures that students' identities, languages, abilities, and talents are recognized and affirmed, and that their learning needs are addressed." So as I wrote in my research, that despite this sort of cri de coeur, there's no content in year 1 to 13 that pertains to students gaining aptitudes of assessing conflict or violence, that violence is intentional, undesirable, and avoidable. And as the sole statement regarding violence in the curriculum, it specifically recognizes cultural and structural forms of violence by looking at sexism and racism and discrimination. But it leaves sort of direct forms of violence absent in that statement. And so if you were looking at whether or not it was important to sort of differentiate between the three, in my field, we look at cultural violence. These are worldviews. structural violence, which are sort of incarnations of held worldviews, and direct violence, which are actually physical acts or threats of harm. So these are what we would consider to be direct forms of violence. And the statement in the New Zealand 1 to 13 year, it says the curriculum is without sexist or racist or discriminatory statements, but it makes no mention about what desirable society should be. And in addition to that, it doesn't mention direct violence at all. And so, you know, in my analysis, the answer for my outcome was it's either difficult for them to represent direct violence discursively, which was surprising to me, or it doesn't consider direct forms of violence undesirable, but sexism and racism, yes. And then conversely, in the Te Whariki early childhood curricular statement, it specifically states that children have a right to protection from physical and mental or emotional abuse and injury, that it's really important children be protected from rough handling and that they think about the importance of not harming others. And that message has no echo after early childhood education, unfortunately. So it's important to notice this from my perspective because, you know, school systems are basically reflectors and generators of our values. And so if violence isn't being recognized, we are limited in our ability to actually address it, prevent it, or intervene in it, which is a very important practice where if there's violence happening in front of you, you actually know what to do. You know how to transform it. So from my analysis of New Zealand, there's a lot of room for adding the ability for us to recognize violence in society around us and then transform it, hopefully.
Goodness, that's pretty deep stuff. That's actually quite upsetting to hear that.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there seems to be, I think, you know, from some of the research that I've been doing, there seems to be a very similar disconnect. In you know, Commonwealth countries like Canada, England, Australia, Scotland, etc., in the analysis that I've done, that there seems to be a real resistance to sort of, you know, taking a stand on the realities of violence. I mean, we have this sort of fence sitting where, you know, education systems are very happy to talk about wellness and well-being, but at the same time, they sort of don't address things that are actually inhibiting our wellness and well-being in society, in terms of interpersonal violence, self-harming, and in terms of sort of these larger grand narratives of what I call war education or organized violence that's considered legitimate. So it's very challenging.
And what do you think is the implication of this then for education and society more broadly?
The implication of
the lack of recognition of it in the curriculum.
Right. Yeah. No, I think it does two things. Number one, I think it gives us a bit of cognitive dissonance, meaning it's confusing because in one respect, when we don't recognize violence, it doesn't mean that it isn't there. It means that we're not being valued in alerting ourselves to its presence. So there seems to be a sort of, I'm not sure what the term would be, but like the record skipping when it gets to that sort of topic. We can talk about all kinds of other things when we talk about, you know, socialized learning and the idea that, you know, we learn as young people what to care about and what to value by what we learn in school. I mean, we do learn a lot of it in the home, but we also learn a significant part of it in what's called so-called secondary socialization out in the world, out in schools, community groups, etc. So when we have this sort of this missing or this gap, this space that's where violence recognition could be, we also don't mobilize to address it. And so in some instances, there's sort of these smaller grassroots attempts to bring more awareness to certain kinds of violence. And in New Zealand, you can certainly see it with different sort of programs or campaigns that are looking at addressing self-harming and suicide or looking at interpersonal violence, domestic violence, etc., and definitely binge drinking. But there is a disconnect when it comes to our curriculum in schools. And the reason why I think that's important is because you can't tell people violence isn't acceptable and then commemorate and celebrate war, which is organized violence, and not expect people to not think or to have some sort of dis-ease about that. And the way that I sort of think about it myself is that it can be a little disturbing when we look at how violence in our society, and in New Zealand is very similar to Canada this way, sort of dissects legitimate violence from illegitimate violence. So if the police or the military are doing it, it's okay. And if an individual does it, it's not okay. And I think that it's, you know, very challenging because we teach students in many, many ways that violence isn't okay, but then at the same time, we turn around and we have these large milestones of the year that are basically all set up to commemorate war, and that becomes a major part of mobilizing our identity, and it's a major part about sort of creating that imagined community, which nationalism does, and education systems are vehicles of this kind of nationalism. They're plays that give you your sort of, as they say, they don't tell you how to think, they tell you what to think about. So when we go to school, if we're looking at creating a society that's going to be nonviolent, it's quite challenging to think about the fact that we won't necessarily achieve that if one of the things that we're doing is teaching children about war, war history, and then the offshoots of that, which I think are quite important as well. I mean, there's incarnations of violence in school curriculum. There's what are called alienations, where people don't feel that their education relates to their culture, to their language, and to their own experience of history. This idea of people being somehow on the outside of education, or that by the example, if we talk about history, education, and war history specifically, there's winners and losers. There's people that come out part of the victors and people that come out as part of the losers on that side. New Zealand's becoming increasingly multicultural, so what does it mean when someone sits down in class and is part of the wrong group? You know, what kind of ability is there for you to identify with your culture? And, you know, this is probably grander than the notion that you're speaking about right now, but this is one of the reasons why people become radical. This is one of the reasons why people espouse forms of sort of extremist violence, because they don't feel they belong. So when we, as I said, learn about parts of history that don't problematize war, we actually end up legitimizing it. And when we legitimize organized violence, which is what war is, how do we then become people who can then legitimately delegitimize other kinds of violence? So I think we need to get off the fence and decide that we want to be nonviolent, which means that when we start to talk about violence in education, violence in terms of our curriculum not meeting necessarily the needs of the students that are in class, but also, more importantly, hiding violence in order to sort of create this national identity. I think we have a lot of challenges, and we can certainly do better.
And just to finish up then, what would be your advice? What do you think should be happening in the classroom in terms of changing this?
Well, I mean, I teach in tertiary education. When I teach my students about war education and that idea of legitimate, you know, versus illegitimate violence, my students are really struck by this. It can be very challenging. But as I said, you know, as someone who teaches at university, I teach about violence. I actually do teach about, you know, physical violence, abuse, structural violence, racism, sexism, ageism, ableism, you know, classism, and also that kind of idea of violence in education, that alienating violence, education that erases us, ignores, derides, or dismisses us. And I do all that because alienating violence is a form of dehumanization. And so I don't teach early childhood education, and I don't teach primary and secondary school, but I think the message has to be humanization. It has to be a place where we recognize that the role that we should be taking as pedagogues in education, particularly mainstream education, is not to sort of support this mythic narrative of who we are, but actually who we need to be to each other on a day-to-day basis. So if we want nonviolent homes, we don't just have to mirror nonviolent behavior. We have to teach nonviolence, because if you don't learn nonviolence, you don't use it. Violence is all around students. They see it everywhere. It's not just in their real lives. It's online. And in order for them to be able to muster ways to counter it, to engage with it, to critique it, and to sort of, you know, transform themselves away from it, they need to know it's coming. So there's all kinds of concern about certain subject matters and age-appropriate learning and all those kinds of things. And again, as I said, I teach adults, so I generally give them one warning, and that's kind of it. But when you when you live in a world that has its blinders on and isn't looking for things, number one, or number two, you're giving people very confusing messages. I think you have a challenge. I mean, I would like to see violence prevention and intervention training from, you know, the age of five. I think it's very important that we learn how to prevent violence before it happens, and there's a myriad of ways to do that. But also, I think equally important, particularly in secondary schools and older, is this idea of intervention training, which is bystander training, which is when it's happening right in front of you, what do you do? And there's various programs out there that look at sort of sharing that kind of information, as well as peer support, as well as having a national message that says, no, it's not okay. We have these, you know, wonderful ads on the television that I'm seeing about it's not okay to you know, to hit your wife. It's not okay to hit your kids. Okay, but why is it okay for us to have Anzac biscuits and poppies as well? I mean, why do we celebrate one kind of violence but not another? I think we need to get on the same message, and I think that nonviolence should be that message.
Perfect. That was a fantastic way of summing it all up. We're speaking now with Laura Jones, who's Museum Education Specialist at Te Papa, New Zealand's National Museum. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Lovely to be here.
To start with, if you could please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about the work that you do.
I actually have an art specialism and a history specialism as part of my brief, but I deliver to all of the programmes. I've got a long background in teaching, mainly in the UK, in London and in Cambridge. I've also taught in Spain, and I've taught a little bit here in New Zealand. And generally, kind of upper primary and going into the intermediate age group is where I have most experience. And I've been working at Te Papa for nearly 3 years. And though I sort of develop programs which relate to art, I've also helped to deliver sort of develop programs which relate to Gallipoli. I certainly spend a lot of time talking to students, taking them on tours, and delivering education programs through that space in Te Papa. Very popular exhibition space.
The Gallipoli exhibition is called The Scale of Our War, with the giant figures.
That's right, yes.
Was that the only World War I related exhibition at Te Papa?
Yes, it definitely is, yeah.
It would be really good to hear about, now that I guess we're coming to the end of the centenary, 4 years, how you feel the exhibition has been received. Do we have an idea of visitor numbers, reactions to the exhibition, that sort of thing?
I wish I could actually give you a figure, but I know the visitor numbers are in the millions. It's been one of the most popular exhibitions that Te Papa has put on. As you say, it was initially designed to be up for 4 years to commemorate the 100 years since the start and the finish of the First World War. There's actually every potential that it will be up for longer, and that's largely in part down to the fact that it has been incredibly well received with a whole variety of audiences. And what's interesting is that it does seem to touch a wide demographic range of people, national visitors and international visitors included. I think what people respond to a lot is the emotionality of the exhibition, the fact that there's an attempt to talk about this particular conflict, Gallipoli, through the eyes, if you like, and the thoughts of these, as you term them, sort of giant figures that are in the exhibition. And I think that approach seems to have worked very well. It's well received.
And you know that, I guess, from the comments in visitors' books?
Comments in visitor books. At the end of the exhibition, you can make comments on poppies and put them into the final figure of Cecil Malthus. And, you know, those are collected and stored and will be read and collated. So I'm sure somebody will be doing some kind of research into that.
Goodness, that's a large job in itself, isn't it?
Absolutely. There will be thousands and thousands of those red poppies to look at.
You take tour groups around. How do people react?
So in general, of course, as the educator, I'm taking through school students. And usually I would say those are years 5 to 13. So to put that into common parlance, that's probably about 10-year-olds up to sort of 17, 18-year-olds. And, of course, with them are their teachers and any sort of adults that are along as well. And it is interesting. In general, I find that in terms of giving a somewhat sort of non-traditional narrative, it's actually well received by students. I don't know, but I'm imagining that it's quite interesting for them to have somebody talk about the conflict in a different way compared to how it's usually talked about. They actually listen very well and really engage with the kind of provocations that I bring up throughout our journey. The feedback from teachers and other adults is that it's well received as well. And I'm often aware that as I'm delivering my education programs through Gallipoli with school students, that other members of the public often kind of shadow me and occasionally come up to me and say, you know, it's really interesting to hear you talk about Gallipoli in this way. It could be that for some visitors, they may find it too challenging, but I haven't actually received any sort of verbal feedback that tells me that. But I can imagine that possibly sometimes some of the things I say are possibly some people find a little challenging.
Can you give us some examples of what you say that perhaps might be conceived as a bit more provocative?
You come into part of the exhibition where there's a projection onto a 3D sort of topographical map, and it shows the landing at Gallipoli. And I gather students around and we talk about who was there. We talk about the British being there and the Anzac troops, the New Zealanders and the Australians. And we talk about the French being there and the Turks being there. And I also make a point that actually also the Canadians and there were Indian troops there as well. And then what I do is I ask the students, why were the Turks there? And it's quite interesting. There's a heartbeat sometimes, just a little pause, and sometimes a little bit longer. And usually, pretty quickly though, a student puts their hand up and says, because it was their country. And then, of course, that just opens up that narrative around the fact that actually we were the invading forces. And often, you know, it's not talked about in that way, but of course, Gallipoli is a part of Turkey, and when the Allied troops landed, they were invading a foreign land. Then, of course, I can talk about how the Turkish soldiers were lined up on the top of the hills and were firing down at the troops trying to make their way up, and actually kind of talk about the fact that, of course, the Turkish soldiers were defending their land, just as New Zealanders, I often say to them, would defend their land if New Zealand were invaded. Now, immediately, very early on, I've just given them a different lens to view Gallipoli through. And I think that's actually very, very powerful. And that's one example of where I do sort of get quite a few adults gathering around me, you know, other visitors to the exhibition, listening into this. I'm occasionally aware when I read their faces that they actually themselves had not thought about it in that way too. It's a matter of objective fact, but it's just a very good example of how when you just give people a different lens to look through, it actually opens up the conversation in a different way.
Yeah, great. It's good to make people think about these things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You mentioned that that's an objective fact, the land was being invaded. I'm interested in the idea of subjectivity as well and exhibitions
yes.
being curated, whatever stories are
yes.
chosen by somebody or multiple people.
Yes.
The idea that whatever we're seeing in the exhibition has been carefully selected.
I absolutely agree with you. And certainly when I've got older students, without a doubt, I make reference to that as we move through the exhibition. And also at the end, one of the ways that I make reference to it, which again I think is quite powerful, and I do this with younger children as well, is there's one female figure in the exhibition. She's the nurse, Lottie Legale. And after I've sort of spoken a bit about that, about Lottie and about her experiences and why she's crying, I then just come out, if you like, from that kind of that space, and then say to them, okay, Lottie is the only female figure in the exhibition, and she's crying, and she has a lot to cry about, undeniably. But there are all of these men in the exhibition, and none of them are crying. Then turn to the students, and I say, do you think that means that men didn't cry? And again, very, very quickly, the students are just not, they just chorus, no, of course they did. They feel it to be true that by this sort of later stage in the exhibition that they've got plenty to cry about. And so then I ask them to contribute ideas as to what they would have cried about, and they come up with the idea of being homesick, the idea of seeing their friends being killed in front of them, the idea of actually being feeling hopeless and feeling trapped or being hurt themselves. All of these are really good reasons as to why men would have cried. And of course, again, we know they did cry. We know this through diary entries and letters home. So we've got the evidence. And I then turn to them and say, now, you know, in this exhibition, we've chosen not to have men cry. What do you think, you know, what messaging do you think that gives you? And again, I'm doing this with older students. And they think about it in terms of, well, it does tend to give the idea that men are staunch. Men are just standing strong in some way. And despite the fact that it is undeniably a very emotional exhibition, it's interesting that none of the men have actually been are shown crying. And I think in doing that, I'm getting the students to reflect on the fact that the group that put the exhibition together made a decision not to have anyone crying. And in doing so, of course, that's a subjective decision. Actually, how realistic a portrayal are you giving, I would argue, of the experience if you don't actually show that? And I just make the point that this exhibition is a bit like a book. They need to think about books and question them as sources, question how they've been written, and they need to question information, how it's presented within exhibitions as well in the same way. And I think that's a very, very powerful message, because then you are sending away students hopefully actually starting to question how information is presented to them. And, you know, let's face it, that's actually a great life lesson anyway.
Definitely. I think what you're talking about with the men not crying is kind of upholding stereotypical values of masculinity in a way.
Yes.
And I
yes.
guess my kind of crux question for you is, do you think that presenting an exhibition about, in this case, Gallipoli, but war in general, is encouraging people to look beyond war to peace?
That's very tricky. I think the focus of this exhibition, the aim is really to immerse you in the awfulness of Gallipoli in some way. And I don't think its brief is really necessarily to talk about what happened after the conflict. However, I will be very interested to see whether other exhibitions do that. I would be hopeful that narrative is actually going to be brought out, you know, later on this year and into next year as we start to talk about the influenza epidemic. So I have to say, if I'm completely honest, that no, I don't think this exhibition leads us into that conversation about peace. My feeling is that people are ready for that kind of conversation now. There's been a lot of talk about Gallipoli, of course, the First World War, and I think people are ready for some alternative narratives. And I hope that that's going to be coming up, because actually talking about the influenza epidemic lead you into thinking about, you know, why the flu spread so rapidly, because everybody was so debilitated and the resistance was so low, because the whole world was, you know, shattered really by the First World War, and populations were decimated in countries, and that allowed the flu epidemic to spread so quickly and so easily. That does allow you to open up conversations around, you know, what happened after the war ended.
Just my final question. We interviewed Dr. Katarina Standish before, who researches violence in school curricula internationally. And one of the comments that she made was that she finds it quite difficult to reconcile the teaching of war with the teaching of non-violent messages. Mm. The idea that violence is legitimized in some spaces, but not in others. Mm. And I guess just your final thoughts on that point.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. One of the things I do in Gallipoli is to get people to think about, you know, how soldiers were absolutely trapped when they signed up. We talk about, you know, how you would feel, how would it be if you refused to fight, if you said, no, this is not what I signed up for. And we often use a figure of Jack Dunn, who fell asleep at his post, as a kind of stimulus for that conversation. He fell asleep at his post. He was actually sentenced to death, which means being, you know, obviously facing a firing squad of your fellow men, your fellow comrades. And we talk about how awful, truly awful that was as a sentence. He actually got his sentence commuted because his commanding officer said, well, you know, actually the man was, he wasn't lazy. He was actually still recovering from pneumonia. But it actually allows us to talk a little bit about how it would be if you actually did refuse to fight. And of course, you would face that same sentence. And the idea that these men were actually, after having been signed up and you know, actually signing up because of all sorts of reasons, actually not really to do with wanting to go off and kill people. War comes up, you're told it's going to be an easy conflict, you're told it's going to finish soon, you know, and you're told you're going to get to travel. And I think these are genuinely probably the real reasons that many men signed up. And actually then they find themselves in this horrific situation where it is rather kill or be killed. And I think that's how I talk about violence within that context of war, that it's forced upon these men. They have no option. They don't really have the option to say, no, I don't want to do that, because they will be killed themselves otherwise. I think when students understand that actually it wasn't a killing spree. These men weren't signing up because they actually wanted to go off and kill the enemy. Well, I guess, you know, some of them may have done, but I think in general that's not accurate. And I think when you explain to them the context of them being, once they've signed up, they are committed, and they have no ways out, no ways of saying no, no ways of escaping, then I think you view the violence in a different light. I think for me, that's how I get around that one.
Well, thank you for that, because it's not an easy question by any means.
No, it isn't. And I do really fully understand it. But I think it's contextualizing that violence and helping students to understand that this was not a great place to be. As soon as you'd signed up and as soon as you landed, it was hell on earth. And yet you had no options but to kind of follow orders. That probably helps to provide that context for the violence.
Thank you very much, Laura, for sharing your expertise with us.
Thank you, Sally. It's been a pleasure.
This episode of Speak Up Korerotia invited guests to ponder, based on their work and experience, the question: does teaching about war simultaneously teach us about peace? Katarina Standish's answer was emphatic. She sees a fundamental disconnect between sanctioned commemoration of so-called legitimate violence and attempts to teach that illegitimate violence is unacceptable, because violence, after all, is still violence. Rowan Light and Laura Jones were not so clear-cut in their views, recognizing the importance of remembering atrocity and learning from it. Laura emphasized the importance of teaching multiple narratives of war, and of challenging people to think about narratives from different perspectives, while Rowan made the point that teaching war doesn't automatically guaranteed teaching piece, but that you might have to actually consciously think about that as a separate thing. Whatever your personal views on the subject, these three guests have hopefully made you pause and reflect a bit on the reasons for commemoration. Something which is certainly critical if commemoration is indeed to act as a reminder and a deterrent against future conflict. This is Sally Carlton with Speak Up Cordeiro. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and our transcripts are available on the websites of the Human Rights Commission and the Christchurch City Libraries. A te rawa.